That is a huge gas field. It's probably the largest fossil fuel project in recent history. When you fully unleash that gas on the world and that's burnt, the life cycle emissions is in the realm of around 15 new coal-fired power stations. And this is the problem. Australia didn't sign these pledges because it wants to sell as much fossil fuel as possible. And that was becoming quite clear to everyone, especially following that weak net zero pledge that the Prime Minister released without anything to back it in.
One for mum, one for dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasure.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we are going to round out our last couple of episodes on the Glasgow COP with a wrap-up of everything that went down in Scotland.
COP26 was billed as the last best chance to save the planet.
Negotiations in Glasgow went on beyond the deadline as draft after draft came closer to producing a global agreement.
No objections, it is so decided.
Deep disappointment, with environmentalists saying COP26 fell far short of the urgent action that's needed.
Like the last minute push from India and China to weaken a commitment to phase out coal.
Express our profound disappointment that the language that we have agreed on coal and fossil fuel subsidies has been further watered down.
It was one of the things we were hoping to carry out of here and back home with pride. And it hurts deeply to see that bright spot dim.
I apologize for the way this process has unfolded. I am deeply sorry. But I think, as you have noted, it's also vital that we protect this package.
We're welcoming back Richie Merzian, Director of the Climate and Energy Program, who has just not long got back from his trip to Scotland. Welcome back, Richie.
Thanks, Ebony. Good to be back home.
How's the jet lag going?
Better than it is for Ben Elquist.
We're delighted to have you back, but I know it was a very big trip, and you're a veteran of many COPs, conferences of the party, the UN Climate Summit. How many COPs have you been to at this point?
I think it's nine.
Nine?
Nine, maybe ten, yeah.
That's impressive. And tell me, coming home, what's your overall impressions of how the Glasgow COP went this time around?
Look, I think my take on the COP has been shaped by my experience, having gone to many of these and seen what is a bad COP, what is very little in terms of progress. And so my take home is this was a qualified success, and mainly because it actually addressed the key source of greenhouse gas emissions, which is fossil fuels. Right, this is a ridiculous situation where the Paris Agreement, only 6 years old, doesn't mention fossil fuels. The convention itself doesn't mention fossil fuels. And so for the first time, you actually had parties, countries coming together and saying, we need to phase down fossil fuels. Let's start with coal, single largest source, and let's actually agree on some decision language to do that and come up with alliances, high ambition approaches to actually phase it down and finance the phase down. And I think that is a great step in the right direction.
Okay, so let's take a step back. When the UK was president of this COP, and what were its goals heading into this thing? What were their aims? And then, I guess, where do we end up against those aims?
So the UK took on this because it's politically significant, this COP, more so than the last four or five, because this was supposed to mark the anniversary of the Paris Agreement, 5 years, nominally six now, like the Olympics, it got pushed a year. But the political significance is that it's the anniversary of the Paris Agreement. It is the five-year mark where we're supposed to ratchet up our ambition, increase what's called the nationally determined contributions, and those are the targets we set for 2030. So that's why it's politically important. It's why over 100 leaders came. But the UK said that's not going to be enough. We also want to consign coal power to history. So they set about an additional agenda on top of the targets to actually look at phasing down coal. How do you do that? How do you bring countries together to align that? How do you finance that? And how do you bring decisions on it?
all the ambition was around 2030, which is why everyone was so disappointed with Australia. What was the impression that other countries had of Australia at this COP?
Australia was a handbrake, a dead weight. And the Prime Minister knew it because he didn't seem to book many meetings when he did go. He went reluctantly. It was off the back of a terrible G20 meeting. And so it didn't go well. If you even look at the words that the Prime Minister used when he addressed the UN climate conference, he said, "Hey, you leaders, you're not going to solve climate change. It's going to be scientists and technologists and engineers."
The challenge of combating climate change will be met the same way. And it will be met by those who, frankly, are largely not in this room. It will be our scientists, our technologists, our engineers, our entrepreneurs, our industrialists and our financiers that will actually chart the path to net zero. And it is up to us as leaders of governments to back them in. Technology will have the answers.
Basically, trying to take his domestic narrative of technology, not taxes, and push it onto the world stage and say, let's absorb ourselves global leadership of the responsibility of climate change and push it onto the private sector because, sure, they'll solve it. And it didn't go down well. The whole reason why there are over 100 leaders there is because they took on the responsibility of their countries to actually lead and to do so by bringing forward decent targets. And what made it worse is Australia went there and saying, we will beat our weak target that's 6 years old and we'll do so with maybe 10 percentage points on top of what we originally agreed, but we're not going to commit to it, which is useless. You can't bank on a projection. The whole point of adding up these targets and seeing what the emissions gap is you add up targets that countries will be held accountable to. Yeah. And there's no accountability in projection. So it did not go down well, Prime Minister Morrison's involvement.
Mm. And what was the mood like there overall? Because obviously there was, because of COVID, a year's delay, there was quite a bit of build-up heading into the Glasgow COP. What was it like when you got there on the ground?
It was good times. Like even though Glasgow was gloomy and rainy and cold, it was good. Like, it was like catching up with old friends. Like, no one had been able to meet together for the last 2 years, so lots of Zoom calls and frustrations, and focusing on a pandemic is quite depressing, more so than I think climate change. That's me personally. So there was good. There was good momentum, good energy. President Biden was there along with numerous members of the US administration off the back of the president's climate summit that he had in April, where he announced that the US will commit to 50% emissions reductions. All of the G7 committed to more. And so there was good energy because the US was back as the second largest emitter. India soon came in and said, as the third largest emitter, it would get to 50% renewable energy this decade. Mm. And then eventually it's finally committed to net zero, even if it is further away than most. So there was good energy and good vibes on the ground. And I think that carried forward.
And it really seemed to me that there was a lot of those side deals this time around. You talked about the energy, the momentum. It was quite clear, even externally, that people had kind of come prepared to do some hard work here, except from Australia, the usual suspects. But walk me through some of those side deals. So you've talked about the UK kind of wanting to consign coal to history. Let's start there. Consigning coal to history.
Yes. So the UK had an energy day, but really it was a let's bash up coal day, which was great, on the Thursday of the first week. And they released a global coal to clean power transition statement, getting numerous countries to commit to massively accelerating renewable energy and to not hand out any more licenses or leases or investment for new coal-fired power stations, what we called unabated or just traditional old-school coal-fired power stations. And you had countries like Vietnam sign up, who's a coal client. They buy coal from Australia. You had countries like Indonesia sign up saying, well, we could do more, especially if we get more money to do that. And Indonesia is the largest exporter of thermal coal. They stitched up a deal with South Africa, UK, South Africa being the largest coal producer, largest coal user in Africa.
So very significant. It's
a big, big deal, and one of the largest developing countries. And South Africa, it will now look to phase out coal thanks to an $8.5 billion deal that the UK and the US and the EU stitched up with them. So these are big plays to consign coal to history that I think we can't shy away from. So the ultimate outcome is that a line was drawn in the sand saying coal's going one way and that's down.
India and China were able to change the wording in the agreement from phase out unabated coal to phase down.
How can anyone expect that developing countries can make promises about phasing out coal and fossil fuel subsidies?
Now making concrete steps forward on eliminating coal from our energy needs is quite substantial.
We've got to stop burning coal and gas. We've got to reduce methane emissions. You know, this is a crisis.
More than 100 countries have formed an alliance to cut methane emissions by 30% during the next decade.
And I think we could probably go beyond that.
Two other deals that I wanted to ask about. One was the methane pledge. Again, this focus on fossil fuels, it's not something that we've seen at previous UN climate summits. That was a pledge to reduce methane emissions by 30% by 2030. Is that right?
Yep.
Who was pushing that and where did that end up?
So again, so this was a US-UK-led approach. The whole point is that when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reported earlier this year, they said that we're going to hit 1.5 degrees of global warming. That's bad. What's worse is when you start shutting down coal power stations, all the particulates that they release, as well as all the carbon pollution, have a global cooling effect. And so things will get worse before they get better. Your best bang for your buck is dealing with methane emissions because they're so much more potent, but they're also short-lived.
Yeah.
So you deal with that by reducing methane at source. That's either in agriculture or that's in mining. And over 100 countries signed this pledge to phase down methane by 30% this decade. Australia didn't. And it didn't because Australia is actually planning on a methane-fired recovery. It wants to increase methane emissions, mainly from the mining sector, because a lot of methane is like 70 to 90% of natural gas is methane.
Yeah.
Right? So when you leak natural gas, you're leaking methane. And a lot of that is leaked when you dig up gas and when you dig up coal. And that's the problem. And I think just in the last 24 hours, another massive new gas field was approved.
I was going to ask you about that. So obviously all these other countries are trying to get off methane and Australia is headed in the total other direction as per usual. But what has been approved in the last couple of days?
So Woodside and BHP announced to the stock market that they'll be investing $6 billion in opening up a massive new gas field called the Scarborough gas field, just west of Karratha in WA.
Woodside and its partner BHP Petroleum have approved the development of one of the nation's largest gas projects off the WA coast.
And it's being described by some environmental groups as Australia's biggest fossil fuel project.
Have you calculated what those Scope 3 emissions are? You would have done the math on that, wouldn't have you?
Yes, and that information is in the public domain.
Can you tell us what those Scope 3 emissions are?
Look, I believe it's in the order of 1.6 billion tonnes of CO2. But again, I think what's important to recognise...
That is a huge gas field. It's probably the largest fossil fuel project in recent history. When you fully unleash that gas on the world and that's burnt, the life cycle emissions is in the realm of around 15 new coal-fired power stations. And this is the problem. Like, gas is not part of the solution, it is part of the problem. And we can't pretend like gas is going to have a transitional fuel when they're locking in massive new emissions, especially when we can go directly to clean energy. And this is the problem. Australia didn't sign these pledges because it wants to sell as much fossil fuel as possible. And that was becoming quite clear to everyone, especially following that weak net zero pledge that the Prime Minister released without anything to back it in.
The last kind of side deal that I wanted to ask about was also a fairly significant one, and it was John Kerry sitting down with the Chinese climate envoy and announcing where they had areas of cooperation. Walk us through that deal and how, I guess, important that is going to be.
This surprised many people. In the last couple of days of the COP, John Kerry, who's the special envoy for climate, he's at a sort of ministerial cabinet level status in the US. He was the foreign minister when they negotiated the Paris Agreement. And his counterpart when he was doing that is a special envoy for China, who was also brought back from retirement to continue being China's chief climate negotiator. Together, they stitched up a deal to cooperate on increasing climate ambition in the 2020s. Which is the key period, or what President Biden calls the decisive decade. And they're going to do that by working together to address a number of things, including methane. And there's a number of clauses within that deal on how to do that.
The United States and China are the equivalent of almost 45% of all the emissions.
And when you add Europe, you're over 50%. So three entities need to work together with a lot of other countries to be serious about reducing emissions and to address this moment of history.
So it's symbolically important because you have the two largest emitters, the two largest economies, geopolitical rivals saying, let's cooperate on this one area because it's essential to both of us. And then you have some detail around how they're going to do that and which areas they're going to cooperate in. And that lended this final wave of momentum to push through a deal at the very end that I think is something that is pretty good. It's definitely not the best, but it's pretty good in terms of moving things on. The other thing to mention as well is there was another deal. It was a little smaller than the big coal deal, mm-hmm. but it was called the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, led by Denmark and Costa Rica. And it was a group of countries that said, not only do we need to phase out coal, we also need to phase out gas and oil. You often extract them together.
Yep.
So we need to phase those out as well.
We hope that today will mark the beginning of the end of oil and gas. When I talk to scientists, citizens, and activists, they all want one thing more than anything else: bold and tangible action. Not talk, action.
And it was like about two dozen countries that signed up for that, and then they also agreed not to finance new oil and gas projects as well. And so you saw countries like New Zealand look at signing up to that as well. So it's useful in terms of changing the narrative that fossil fuels aren't part of the solution. We should stop pretending like they can clean up their act through CCS and through other methods. Really, if we want to deal with climate change, we have to phase down fossil fuels.
I just want to touch on a couple of other areas before I guess we come to that final wording and where to from here. One is finance and the other is adaptation. So I know we've spoken previously about climate finance and how important that was and Australia kind of really taking a step back from that. What happened on the finance front?
So on finance, a number of developing countries were frustrated because there'd been this deal that developed countries should help mobilize $100 billion per year by 2020. Now, when you looked at the numbers, it hadn't reached that level. And so there was a bit of, you know, make good at the COP. And that came down to agreeing that there should be $500 billion mobilized between 2020 and 2025. So that's the kind of, all right, you didn't get there, at least make sure the next couple of years are going to be good, and then agreeing on a new target for the next period, which will be discussed in the next couple of COPs.
Yep.
So it fell short of where a number of countries wanted to get to, because ultimately, if you want developing countries, especially countries that are far less wealthy than Australia, to do more, then often they require the finance to do more.
Yeah.
And that's really why finance is the glue that brings a package together. I think we'll see a lot more on finance going forward. We know that Egypt is hosting the next COP, and finance is always a major issue for Egypt and also for Africa.
Yeah. And so take us then, I guess, to that final wording, which gets hammered out, you know, right until the very last minute, I'm sure. There was a lot of coverage of the fact that a coal phase out was watered down to phase down.
India and China were able to change the wording in the agreement from phase out unabated coal to phase down.
How can anyone expect that developing countries can make promises about phasing out coal and fossil fuel subsidies?
It's the first time a COP agreement has mentioned the phasing down of coal, and it's also asked nations to come back next year with increased emissions reduction targets.
We are now making concrete steps forward on eliminating coal from our energy needs is quite substantial.
But what are some of the key provisions in that final Glasgow Pact that Australia signed up to, and what does that mean for next year heading back to Egypt?
I mean, this COP didn't go as late as the last one, so it's kind of good in the sense that it actually finished on Saturday afternoon, like only 28 hours overtime. And it was always controversial putting in language around fossil fuels. There has been such strong pushback. It's ridiculous when you think about it, right? If we have a convention on tobacco or narcotics or weapons, you'd be dealing with the producers as much as you are the users, but not in this case. And so there is a strong pushback, and unfortunately, there's no precedent to draw on. And so I just think it's amazing that we even got language in. Like, it really was touch and go.
Yeah, as we were saying, it's like it's never been in the language before.
Exactly. So it's a beachhead. It's a starting point. And even if it is highly qualified and highly watered down, it's still in there. What was ultimately agreed is that countries will take actions to phase down unabated coal power.
And just remind us again, what is unabated coal power?
So look, unabated, it's one of those weasel words. It can be many things to many people. It can be a slightly better version of the crappiest coal-fired power station. Or it can mean that any coal-fired power station has to have a full carbon capture and storage facility bolted onto it, which we know is never really worked despite billions of dollars spent. You don't have CCS with coal. You don't have clean coal.
No, we don't. Greg Hunt, I'm pretty sure, promised it at one point. So did the World Coal Association about 5 years before Greg Hunt. I'm yet to see anything bolted on to any coal-fired power plant in Australia.
It's about as credible as Bolt himself on Sky After Dark. So it just doesn't really exist. And so if you take it through that frame, if you look at the UK's global call to clean power transition statement, they actually define unabated. And they're saying basically that it's coal power that is not mitigated with technologies to reduce carbon dioxide emissions like carbon capture, utilization, and storage. So if you take it through that frame, really you have to tack on some pretty high-tech stuff that actually works, which we haven't really nailed down to begin with, which means that if you see another coal-fired power station, just a traditional one built, then it is not in compliance with the text. If you see one built with some weak version of CCS that doesn't work, then it's not in compliance with the text. So it really does send a message through, think twice before you build anything to generate electricity from coal. That's the useful part here. And the precedent in the UK is that they said, look, we're not going to have any more coal power unless it's unabated. And it was so expensive to do that, that they just moved completely away from coal. Because if we think about it, coal is more expensive than renewable electricity right now.
Already.
Let alone tacking on a ridiculous, high-tech piece of it hasn't really worked yet. So a piece of technology that is questionable to begin with, you're looking at a situation that is highly unlikely. And
massively expensive for consumers.
Exactly. So, you could take it both ways. One, it's unfortunate it was watered down. But at the same time, it just doesn't seem like it's going to stack up either.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to ask about was these 2030 targets, because obviously you've talked about the fact that, the UN can't bank on a projection. Almost within, I think it was within 12 hours of Australia signing the Glasgow Pact, we had the Minister Angus Taylor and the Foreign Minister Maurice Payne out there saying, Australia's 2030 targets, they're not for changing, and, we're not going to do anything about this.
Australia signed the Glasgow Climate Summit's final agreement, including a request for nations to set more ambitious 2030 targets. A few hours later, the federal government said its 2030 target was fixed.
Well, that's after agreeing to the Glasgow Climate Pact. You signed it, but you don't mean it, is that right?
No, that's not correct, Fran. Look, we, as you know, update our projections every year for 2030. We're on track to meet and beat our 2030 targets. In fact, we're on.
But there's a clear kind of feeling, I think, that Australia hadn't done its homework and they're going to get called out every year unless we do, basically. Is that what's going to happen from now on?
Yes. If you just take the spirit of the... So the agreement is basically it requests countries to update the actual target for 2030.
If they haven't already.
If they haven't already.
Yeah.
A 2030 target in Australia is the same. So whilst the NDC, the Nationally Determined Contribution, the actual document itself was updated in that some new things were added to it, the actual target itself wasn't. And so really the government has two choices. That's why it's requests. It's binary. You do it or you don't do it. And they said, we're not going to do it, which means that they are already in contravention of what they just agreed to.
And of course, Barnaby Joyce famously, the Nationals didn't sign the Glasgow Pact. So how could we possibly hold them to account for it?
And it's not like the Nationals are in government.
It's
not like the Deputy Prime Minister. Look, this is what's ridiculous, right? And this is why Australia is not taken in good faith. Like when, you hear complaints from the Australian government that, people are just like, Sky News said that we were being unpatriotic because we said that the Australian government's position was fraudulent. And then, it takes less than 12 hours before they themselves admit that they're not going to comply with what was ultimately agreed. Yeah. And that's why you can't take the Australian government at face value, because they don't follow through on what they promise. And that's not just harming this particular negotiation on climate. It's harming Australia's overall reputation in the international space. And it's disappointing the foreign minister isn't involved in Australia's climate negotiations, even though she's responsible for them, because it is harming our global reputation.
And in terms of our global reputation, it really struck me, I guess, that the United States and China were finding areas of cooperation. I still don't think Australia has any diplomatic relationship with China at the moment. We were like a shag on a rock out there with Saudi Arabia and Russia trying to water down this agreement. I mean, it just seems like a very bleak future for Australia when we're a middle power who needs allies. Like, we're just not making friends anywhere.
No, Australia's all for a rules-based system until those rules apply to Australia on something it doesn't want to do.
Yeah.
It is harming Australia. And the real pity is that when Prime Minister Morrison was called a liar in Rome at the G20, he then flew to Glasgow. If Australia was actually a decent player on climate change, it would have flew there into the embrace of its forever friends, the UK and the US, and stood on the podium and actually announced a decent climate approach and rallied others to do the same, because we all know Australia's on the front line of climate impacts. Instead, Morrison had to lay low, didn't do anything big. Same with Minister Taylor, because Australia is a laggard. I mean, Twiggy Forrest was getting FaceTime with President Biden. I didn't see once Prime Minister Morrison do anything public apart from the 3-minute speech, which went down like a lead balloon.
Yeah, not many people there to hear it either.
No.
From what I can see.
No, and look, and this is not, it's not a critique of the Australian diplomats there.
Yeah.
They do as good a job as they can in the situation they
have. In the little tiny box of parameters they're given.
But they're given a really crappy mandate, and their job is to deliver it. And much like lawyers who are given a brief, diplomats have a certain amount of wiggle room, and that's it. And so if we want to change the system, we have to change the politics. And that starts with the Prime Minister and Minister Taylor and actually forcing through a decent position.
We're headed towards an election, Richie.
Timely.
And 2030, you know, the Business Council of Australia has come out. Their modelling backs the fact that if we take earlier decisive action this decade, that's where the economic benefits are going to be. We know climate change is really important to the Australian public, but the government has essentially decided it's committing to net zero by 2050 at the same time as it's promoting 100-plus gas and coal projects.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister has hit the road in the New South Wales Hunter region, reassuring coal communities they have a bright future under the government's climate
target. There's never been stronger demand for our coal, and given the fact that the agreement did not say that coal needs to be phased down or taken out, it's a big green light for us to build more coal mines, supply the world more coal.
Things are pretty bleak on the domestic front there, but how important is it going to be, climate change at this election, do you think?
I want it to be important, so let's start there. You know, based on Climate of the Nation 2021, we know that concern is at an all-time high, that concern for climate change didn't abate during the pandemic. And we know that the economics are on our side. So you have the Business Council, you have many corporates who have signed up for net zero, many who are willing to take action right now and make big investment plays. And so the economics are on our side, the popularity is there, and you have an opposition that's warming to a stronger climate policy. Let's find out where that goes. But you also have subnational governments, even led by the Coalition or Liberals, pushing ahead. New South Wales Coalition wants 50% emissions reductions by 2030, wants the federal government to do the same. So everyone else is there, which makes me think that there should be a serious contest of ideas for the 2022 federal election.
Yeah, you've just reminded me, before we wrap up, we saw several subnational Australian governments, as in state governments, state and territory governments, signing up to the UN agreement around electrifying transport. Matt Keane made that announcement, I think, on Sky, and was asked, you know, is this going to happen? Is DFAT really going to let you do this? And he was like, I've signed it. I've sent it to DFAT. And I think it was approved within 24 hours. But yeah, the states is really where the action is happening.
That's right. And they're literally not waiting for the federal government to approve their actions. You know, I'm sure if their travel restrictions were easier, we would have seen a lot more people at Glasgow. The appetite was certainly there, and it's great to see that. So I think you're going to see that filtering up of ideas and pressure come from the bottom, because it's certainly coming in from the top.
And if listeners are anything like me and lived in a lockdown state for however briefly in Canberra, we're all considering moving to electric vehicles as much as quickly as possible after filling my tank for the first time in 2 months. I got such a rude shock. It cost me $25 more to fill my car than it used to.
Well, look, electricity, you know, prices, petrol prices, they'll all be lower with the coalition government there, Ebony.
I'll believe it when I see it. They're skyrocketing at the moment.
The other thing is just there will be another COP in 2022. It won't be as politically significant because it won't be like an anniversary, like the five-year mark to ratchet up ambition, but it'll still keep the pressure on, and it will require an Australian government to bring a better 2030 target and to front up at a ministerial roundtable to defend that. Yep. So that'll be a really useful moment to actually see how that's all going to play out. There will be more COPs and more climate action, and hopefully Australia will be improving its position next time.
Just got to keep fighting until we get somewhere.
That's it.
Thanks very much, Richie. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 23rd of November, 2021, and things may have changed since recording. You can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and Richie Merzian is at Richie Merzian. Our producer, Jennifer Macy, is at Jennifer Macy, and additional editing from Eliza Closer. And our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Stay safe out there. Get vaccinated as soon as you can. Think about switching to an electric vehicle when you can. And thanks for listening.